Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And Merry Christmas Eve, everyone. Welcome to the Three Martini Lunch and day two of our six-part year-end award series for Political Awards 2015. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, who is also the co-author of Heavy Lifting. Our crystal martinis for today are for Sorry to See You Go, Rising Star, and Political Figure Fading into Oblivion. So we start with, obviously, someone that was significant that passed away in 2015. Jim, this is a major theme I think that's going to be going out through all these awards is this was a terrible year. And this category is no different. This was a year where a lot of good people that I knew and politically related people that I knew died. The father of a very good friend of mine who was a good conservative inspirer died earlier this year. The person who mentored me here at Radio America passed away in November. But the one I'm going to spend the most time on here today is a critical figure in the conservative movement who was there for decades and decades and decades. It's a name a lot of people in the movement know, but across the country, the name might be a little fuzzy or not known at all. He died in March, and his name is M. Stanton Evans. He was 80 years old, and he followed, to some extent, in Buckley's footsteps at Yale and became an iconoclast there. He was a frequent contributor to National Review. He was at the vaunted Sharon Statement meeting at Buckley's home in Connecticut and was actually the person who wrote down the Sharon Statement, which was the articulation of conservative principles very early on in the modern conservative movement. He became the editor, the youngest editor in the nation of the Indianapolis Star at the age of 26. Later, he became the head of the American Conservative Union and in 1974 started something that eventually became known as CPAC. So obviously a critical cog in the conservative movement there. He later started the National Journalism Center, which was designed to train journalists how to do the story right, to get the facts, to get all sides of the story. I'm a proud alum of that program. He was an ardent anti-communist, even wrote a book called Blacklisted by History, defending Joe McCarthy. Other books included The Theme is Freedom, talking about our God-given rights. This was a guy who could argue with the most elite academic thinkers in the world, but he preferred beat-up jeans to suits, driving an old truck, and eating burgers at Roy Rogers compared to fancy dinners. One of the funniest people also that you'll ever meet. The absolute definition of a happy warrior. His quotes are legendary. I'm only going to offer a couple of them, but here are two of my favorites. This one is a tad blue, but I think it's good. Tax cuts are like sex. When they're good, they are very, very good. And when they're bad, they're still pretty good. And his other one was, we have two parties here and only two. One is the evil party and the other is the stupid party. I'm very proud to be a member of the stupid party. Occasionally, the two parties get together to do something that's both evil and stupid. That's called bipartisanship. So that's M. Stanton Evans, a guy with a flair for life, trained a lot of good journalists, was an outstanding one himself. Absolute loyal figure in the conservative movement for better than 50 years.
That is a really good choice, Greg. I'm glad I didn't pick him, though, because then I'd have to make up something really quick right here. and instead, I went with a much more familiar name, but I think a vitally important one, former Senator Fred Thompson.
Yes.
We can argue about what, and I'm thinking mostly about the context of the 2008 campaign. This is a guy, look, what about a life well lived? We all remember his roles from the movies and kind of the novelty of this, you know, recognizable face from Hollywood, this reliable character actor running for Senate in 1994, winning and then winning a re-election to another full term, being a solid voice in the Senate, having once been a counsel to committees in the past. One of the things I remember thinking a lot about since his passage is the 2008 campaign, which was, you know, by no stretch of the imagination a success and by a lot of measuring sticks, a disappointment. We can argue about whether if he'd been the nominee, he would have done better than McCain. But there were quite a few tales that Fred Thompson was a guy who didn't want to bother with all the hassle and aggravation of running for president. This was a guy who didn't like doing fundraising events and schmoozing, and that he was I've heard tales about him kind of, you know, wandering away from those events if he thought no one was watching him. This was a guy who actually knew a lot about policy and wanted to know more. I remember seeing him on a National Review cruise and actually listening to the other panelists. And even when he wasn't up on stage and taking notes, like he just was a political junkie who cared about this kind of stuff. The fact that he was so exasperated with the process of running for president, is you know, probably somehow makes him even more likable. Right? This is a guy who wanted to do things and didn't want to spend a lot of time with what the show business aspect that was coming to dominate politics. And I think one of my favorite moments of his from that campaign, it was not too long before he departed the race, but it was an awful debate run by the Iowa, over in Iowa. The Des Moines Register was one of the sponsors. And at one point, the moderator who was from the Des Moines Register asked a two-part question and wanted you to raise your hands if you agreed with it. And at one point, he just said, no hand shows. I'm not doing any hand shows today. And it was just this great, I'm tired of this nonsense. I could have used another word there. You know, this is ridiculous. This is silly. You are not taking the duties and the process of selecting a president seriously. And I kind of liked his just shutting it down and just basically saying, you know, the willingness to say, no, this is stupid. And kind of, you know, push back against a moderator like that. If you feel like we've gone wrong as a country in the last decade or so, Greg, I think you can make a strong argument that the fact that Fred Thompson really went nowhere in that race was a leading indicator that we were going off the tracks. That he deserved a better, a more serious hearing and more serious consideration than he got that cycle. He was certainly the guy who, had he hung around long enough, I would have supported. But we all know how it shook out, and he will be greatly missed. Key figure and probably one of the most liked figure in the conservative movement.
Absolutely. Just a wonderful person and very well respected, as you said. And he, I believe, did radio after that. He wanted to be the next Paul Harvey. Unfortunately, his health took him in a different direction, but he was always pretty active on social media. He had some of the funniest Twitter reactions to news that happened, and bringing in humor and irony to all the different crazy developments from the Obama administration. And so he was always one that could bring a smile to your face. But mm-hmm. on to the rising star, and there were obviously a lot of Senate seats Republicans picked up in 2014. Among them was in the state of Arkansas. It was supposed to be a tight race. Iraq war vet and Congressman Tom Cotton ended up drubbing Mark Pryor by somewhere between 15 and 20 points. It wasn't even close. The wave definitely a big plus for Tom Cotton in 2014. He came to Washington, didn't become this strident blowhard in the Senate, but he became a leader right away on one of the most critical issues of the year, and that was fighting against the Obama administration's insatiable desire to strike this nuclear agreement with the Iranians. He fought tooth and nail to try and force it to be considered a treaty. He wrote an open letter to the Iranian regime pointing out the fact that this deal doesn't have any teeth whatsoever because the Senate has to have a say on it. Then, of course, came the disastrous Corker-Cardin deal where they basically let the president off the hook by not calling it a treaty and forcing lawmakers to vote a two-thirds majority to block the deal rather than needing two-thirds to support the deal. And when Corker-Cardin came through the Senate, Tom Cotton was the only one. Remember that on the campaign mm-hmm. trail. Tom Cotton was the only one to oppose it, not because he didn't want Congress to have a say, but because he thought this was essentially a surrender, and he was right. So Tom Cotton, a guy who's still in his 30s, very bright future ahead of him, and he's not only leading, but leading in a way that shows that has a very smart way of approaching these critical issues.
That's a really good choice, Greg. Now, yesterday you had mentioned Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse in the most honest category.
Right.
I'm putting him in the rising star category today. Probably the most spectacular example of why he deserves this title was his short but powerful message about the San Bernardino attacks that he recorded from the site. It was very clear he was speaking from the heart. It was pitch perfect. It's strange. It shouldn't be such a hard point to make. America is not at war with Islam, but you can't run around like Hillary Clinton saying Islam has nothing to do with it. We are at war with violent jihadists, Islamists. Pick the term you like. This is the group we're up against. And he talked about just kind of our first constitutional principles and why we have to do this and why they hate us. Covered a lot of territory in about 4 or 5 minutes. And I don't know if it was off the cuff or that rehearsed. It certainly didn't. It wasn't like he was using a telestrator or notes or anything like that or cue cards. He's a serious conservative. He's been on the cover of National Review like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. Now, last time we talked about him earlier this year, Greg, I said you could see him running for president someday. Word has reached me that this comment generated some eye rolling in the Ben Sasse office. So they don't want to encourage that, but I still think it's not an unthinkable scenario for 2020, 2024, 2028. And again, it's a very young guy, great depth and breadth of policy knowledge, healthcare policy, education policy. He was head of a university system, head of a hospital system. He knows what he's talking about. Good, succinct explainer of complicated topics, and definitely a guy to keep an eye on in the years to come.
Absolutely. We've said before that the current presidential crop proves that we have a much deeper bench than Democrats. When you factor in the new blood coming into Washington from the last couple of wave elections for Republicans, the bench is very, very deep indeed. And Ben Sasse is certainly one of those people to keep an eye on going forward, and a rock solid conservative to boot. So on to fading into oblivion. This one was so obvious that I almost didn't do it because it was too easy. But John Boehner, this is a guy who obviously was the Republican leader, I believe, from 2007 on. After the Republicans gained the majority, 2011, he became the speaker. As time went on, members of his own caucus bristled at the fact that he ended up basically negotiating with the White House on his own with maybe a couple of other lawmakers rather than going through regular order or at least getting input on different things. As time went on, that war on the conference members, and his speakership got challenged a couple of times on the floor during speaker elections. And regardless of what you think of that tactic, it showed that there was a fracture in the conference. Then there was this motion over the summer to have a resolution of no confidence in the speaker or to challenge the chair. Ultimately, Boehner decided that even if he could survive the vote, that it would do more harm than good. So he's on his way out. And Jim, I don't think he's missing it too much, but it was time for new leadership, to say the least. And hopefully Paul Ryan can provide it. But I think we've probably heard the last in the headlines of John Boehner for quite a while.
He's had his day in the sun. Quite a few of them, actually. And I think that's a pretty good choice. One of your picks that makes me say, I should have picked that one. Because I wanted the choice that doesn't make me happy at all. And in fact, I think probably illustrates one of the reasons, one of the big gripes I had with 2015. I picked Scott Walker as the figure who will be fading into oblivion. Now, people might say, oh, that's harsh. He's still going to be governor of Wisconsin. And it's very conceivable that he'll be the next Tommy Thompson, a serious multi-term governor who has a long-lasting legacy in his state. Having said that, his legacy, you know, if being the next Tommy Thompson isn't fading into oblivion, kind of close. I made the argument a few weeks ago that Obama had one of the worst years in Washington, but maybe Scott Walker had the worst year in politics. His stature and standing in the party fell just unbelievably fast. And what I started marveling about, Greg, is that, man, this wasn't a scandal. It wasn't any particularly devastating gaffe. It wasn't he made some sort of giant, serious policy misstep. If you look at what, you know, what went wrong for Scott Walker this year, you know, he didn't speak up very much in the debates. And when he did, he didn't say much that was memorable. And he had a campaign that had a really unsustainable burn rate, you know, way too much money going out and not enough money coming in. And yet, you know, the guy's got a really good record as governor. And I think he deserved a more serious consideration from the GOP field. So, you know, people who are listening to the entire series of these awards might recognize it. One of my themes of this year is that the GOP donors, the small dollar donors, the poll respondents, and kind of the whole Republican Party as a whole dismissed good presidential candidate options and spent way too much time enraptured with bad ones. And I think Scott Walker deserves better, but life doesn't always give you what you deserve. And I think it'll be a long time before anybody in Washington or the kind of the national political scene says, hey, what's Scott Walker doing these days?
Good choice. Excellent choice. That was one of the most stunning things I saw all year as well, because Scott Walker seemed to have that perfect combination of rock-solid conservative credentials and a guy who rolled up his sleeves and got things done. And for whatever reason, it could be the fact that he was dominated by larger personalities in the campaign. And obviously, the money was a critical factor, as you mentioned. But ultimately, after looking really good in early Iowa polls, just kept fading and fading. And ultimately, the balance sheet forced him out of the race. But it's a shame because I think he could have been a good president, and he certainly would have been a major contributor to this campaign going forward.
Yeah, and just, you know, two other points that kind of come to mind just to illustrate this. 2014, National Review crews. We've got about 500 people in the room, National Review readers, all rock rib conservatives. And I asked the entire panel, all right, who's the Republican ticket going to be? And some people answer, some people dodge. And finally, I say, okay, my guess is it's going to be the Republican ticket in 2016 will be Scott Walker and Susana Martinez. And the room erupts, and everybody likes it. That sounds like a really good choice. Everybody really likes those selections. And, you know, that's November 2014. By mid-year 2015, he's out. And he just kind of just, you know, it happened so quickly. I think one of the reasons that he seemed strong going in was that he seemed like a guy who could appeal to both, you know, for lack of a better term, the Tea Party and the establishment, right? The conservative grassroots and the folks who are kind of wary of the entertainment wing, who want to see serious accomplishments, who want to see. And in the end, he didn't really appeal to either one of them, mm-hmm. which was really bizarre. And, you know, we'll see how things shake out. But I think we left a lot of good talent, got cut from the team early this year.
Yeah, that certainly ought to be something that folks consider when you think of Perry and Jindal also being cut early. Jim, great start to this series. Merry Christmas to you and your family. We'll pick up the awards again on Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for listening. Merry Christmas, one and all, to our listeners. And be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next installment of the Year End Awards on the 3 Martini Lunch.